Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book Spider podcast. This is a Book of the Week format podcast where we discuss a book with the greatest analytical rigor we can bear, and usually more than our listeners can bear. This week, we're discussing Otessa Moshfegh's Eileen. The author's name, I think, is pronounced in a different and consistently inaccurate way every single time it's said in the podcast, so apologies ahead of time for that. Now, Eileen, of course, was recently adapted into a film. We've chosen it as a subject for this week as a way of capitalizing on the interest around that film while also not actually discussing the film on the podcast much, since only one of the three of us has seen it. The film does provide a context for the first of the questions that we get into, but really just the one. So it's not really a podcast about the film or about the comparison, even though it does briefly seem that way at the beginning. A little recap here if you haven't read Eileen recently. Spoiler warning for those who haven't read it at all and wish to do so. I would advise that you do that and maybe come back to this episode. Eileen is narrated by the titular Eileen Dunlop, who's 24 and lives with her abusive alcoholic father, works in a boys' prison in a dreary New England town sometime during the Johnson administration. The first half of the novel follows Eileen through the routines of her days, invisible, powerless, voyeuristically interested in, but also repulsed by the people around her. It's narrated by Eileen in her 70s, looking back on her life from the present day in a very long chronological distance. In the second half of the novel, which is really where it switches from being kind of a account of her day-to-day life into something more plot-driven, Rebecca falls into a state of infatuation that's not really romantic or sexual with Rebecca St. John, a psychologist who's been hired to remodel the prison's educational system. And on Christmas Eve, Eileen goes to what she thinks is Rebecca's house, discovers it's actually the house of the Polk family, whose son Leonard is in prison for murdering his father. And Rebecca has Mrs. Polk in the basement. Together, they attempt to get Mrs. Polk to discuss the family's history of abuse, but Mrs. Polk is shot accidentally. Eileen initially plans to frame her father for the murder and leave with Rebecca, but then realizes that Rebecca's not going to do that, and Eileen ends up fleeing to New York on her own, leaving her past behind and beginning a new life. I'm joined, as always, by the other two hosts of the Book Spider podcast, Chris Malmberg and Patrick Barney. So my first question is, what did you guys take to be the nature of the attraction or the interest that Eileen feels toward Rebecca? Is there some component of sublimated or half-understood romantic or sexual attraction, or is it something more abstract or some mix of those things? What is it that she feels for her?
I think it'd be cool if there was some kind of sublimated sexual attraction, since that would maybe meet one of the criticisms I have of the book. Though I don't know if there is this sublimated sexual attraction. On the surface, it seems to me like Eileen likes Rebecca's ostensible confidence and learnedness. Does that seem right?
Yeah, her confidence, her learnedness, her glamour. I mean, she represents a lot of things that Eileen wants to be, essentially, right? She represents, she's very different from the town that she lives in and she hates, and she represents a lot of things that Eileen would want to be able to find in herself. What were you going to say, Chris?
Well, I'd say that I don't know that Eileen totally understands sexuality or differentiates, like, between her very naive sexual urges and just general sort of attraction and admiration, because she feels so stunted in her maturation at this point when the book is sort of like, when she's telling the story that she's telling about herself. Because as you note in some of your other questions, this is a frame story, and she's older and telling us about this time in her 20s, and she really does, I think, sort of frame herself as someone who is stuck in this place and also stuck with a very innocent, innocent's the wrong way of putting it, definitely not innocent, but very naive sense of sexuality. And I think that that might lend itself to like how her attraction to Rebecca conflates with sexuality, but doesn't quite become sexual.
When you say conflates with sexuality, but doesn't quite become sexual, can you elaborate that a bit?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of really bad, unhealthy sexual modeling going on around Eileen. It's suggested pretty strongly that her father had a sexual relationship with her sister. And of course we come to the end and we have another example of a father sexually abusing a child. And so the things I feel like there's a kind of a sense that this place that Eileen escaped from is permeated with pretty perverse, unhealthy sexual, like, just I don't know how to put it, but I think that she I think to an unclear extent, Eileen has been sort of defending herself against that and sort of like not engaging with the world. You know, she talks about a time when she went on a date with one of her father's old friend's sons, and how she felt like she was being like he was being really aggressive in making out with her, but she pretty much immediately, from the perspective later on in her life, says that he had, you know, barely kissed her and had his hand on her thigh. It wasn't really like trying to do more. So I kind of feel like there's some unspoken, I don't know if anything like more happened to her than what she's already described, but I think that she's she kind of protects herself from actually like realizing her sexuality while engaging in really naive flights of fancy about sexuality. And I think that is just a space for her to you know, have kind of fantasies about Rebecca that can feel sexual but aren't actually very sexual, at least not to in the perspective of her older self.
Patrick, you said a minute ago that if there were more of a romantic attraction between the two of them, it would address one of your criticisms of the book. What did you mean by that?
Well, so my main criticism was actually I was critical of this element in the other novel we read by Moshfegh. The other novel we read was My Year of Rest and Relaxation, right? And at the end of that novel, she references the 9/11 terrorist attack, right? And I remember feeling like it was unnecessary. Like, we could have had the same ending with something a little different, like if without even mentioning the 9/11 terrorist attack. And this novel is set in the 60s. And similarly, I felt like the element of the 60s, while it did add a little bit of flavor, was a little underutilized to my mind. Like, There are some references, like Rebecca St. John seems to be interested in Freudian theory, and there's some other references, but like I didn't see how it being in the 60s really reinforced any themes. Now obviously I'm open to hearing like counter arguments to this or whatever you think about that, but if like there were this like subliminal sexual attraction or sexual relationship between Eileen and Rebecca, then we would have had a resonance between some of the 60s Freudian stuff. Like that would have pointed me in some kind of thematic direction. But of course, as I said, I didn't think it was there, or I wasn't certain it was there.
Well, I think that this isn't thematic so much as it is kind of a structural necessity, right? But like the novel is narrated by a much older Eileen who's had her whole life since then, right? And the perspective that that older narrator has, the distance that the older narrator has from that younger self, the fact that the older narrator is speaking at the end of a life, that seems, I don't know that I could point to that as thematically important, but the kind of texture and flavor of the novel are incredibly determined by that voice, right? Like so much of what makes the novel resonant and interesting to me was the flavor of that voice, the way in which the young Eileen's perceptions and the older Eileen's analysis clash with or interact with each other.
Right. No. I definitely agree that like the difference between the two voices is important, certainly.
Well, and I think just at the most kind of pragmatic, on the most, like you have to set the novel in an earlier time period, or older Eileen is speaking in like 2090, which would be kind of odd, right? It becomes kind of a sci-fi novel then. So I don't know if there's the period setting. I mean, I don't know. I'd have to think a bit as far as other thematic things that does. I don't know if I have a great answer to that, but you have to set the novel in the past because the temporal distance between the narrator and the action is important, right?
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, I guess I agree.
I mean, it could have been the 50s or the 70s, I guess.
I agree that like the distance between the older narrator and the younger self is certainly integral to the novel. I don't know that, like, I personally don't see why putting the older version in the 2070s or whatever, why that's worse. Like if we put the older version in the 2070s and we put the younger version now, obviously that changes the novel somewhat. But it doesn't strike me as like a huge, like you wouldn't even need to make it super sci-fi. Like you don't necessarily have to reference any of the technology of the future, but I don't know.
I'll weigh in here just to say that I kind of get where Patrick's coming from. And I'm going to use my year of rest and relaxation as a different sort of comparison, because I actually, one of the things I want to say, I really loved Eileen. I really enjoyed the book. And I hadn't thought about this until Patrick brought it up. It wasn't necessarily.
Yeah, because I'm a genius.
I know, Patrick. We all know this. But the so I do kind of feel like the texture of the time is a little bit like muted in a way that feels sort of reflective of, or it feels like someone who's writing about a time that is not their own for a kind of divide, like basically for a mechanical, pragmatic reason. You know, this has to be set in the 60s for the voice that Eileen is telling the story from to kind of align more with a voice that Otessa Mashvig is, you know, might be, you know, it's just more easily adopted. I'm telling this story from this point in time about this time in the past. But I do kind of feel like my Year of Rest and Relaxation, which I adore, like it's one of my favorite books of the past few years, is just a little bit more alive, like with details that feel like they're set in a very specific time, because the time is closer to now, is a time that the author actually lived through. So I think that there's something there. I think that it's like a very, for me, it's just a kind of a note that I do kind of understand maybe where Patrick is coming from with that. Like, I think, like, you know, maybe this book feels a little bit more alive if it's set in a time that the author actually lived through. You know, it's a pretty small criticism.
And I guess for me, like, I think I agree with everything you're saying, Chris. Like, I think you really described my feeling, except that my feeling is I just end up being way more critical. Like, I really enjoyed my Year of Rest and Relaxation, thought it was awesome, you know, except for the minor, like, part at the end. But then this one I thought was significantly less good than because of this historical voice issue.
I mean, I do actually totally agree with your point, Chris, that the period detail in my Year of Rest and Relaxation, I agree that it is much more, it feels much more lived in than the period detail in Eileen, for, I think, pretty obvious reasons. I mean, I think partly because, and maybe I'm not qualified to say this, I suppose, but I mean, partly because so much of the period detail in my Year of Rest and Relaxation is pop culture, right? And there's a way in which in the late 90s or the early 2000s, you could kind of immerse yourself in pop culture. And I think that, again, like, I guess I wouldn't know from direct experience, but my sense is that you could immerse yourself in pop culture to a much greater scale then, right? I mean, that is part of what that novel is about. And people's identities were defined in that period, in the late 90s, early 2000s. Their identities and experience were defined by pop culture to a stronger extent than in the period being described by Eileen. I guess I do. I mean, I see the point that, like, it, I see the point that it being set in the mid-60s doesn't necessarily seem absolutely integral to the structure of the novel, and that you could have put it in the 70s or the 80s probably and not had anything seem too different necessarily. I guess it just doesn't, like, that doesn't bother me, really. I don't know. That just doesn't seem like something, I just don't, I don't know. Like, I don't care particularly. The particular question of the nature of the relationship, the nature of the attraction, part of the reason that I let off with that, and I'm going to work very, very hard here to not bring in the movie much, right? I saw it in the last couple days, so it's kind of in my mind in a way that it's, you know, it normally is. It's going to be a little harder to get away from it than normally would be because it's such a recent experience. But I'm going to try not to mention the movie, except that part of the reason I let off with the question is that, you know, the movie is, I think, it much more clearly defines Eileen's attraction to Rebecca as being romantic, right? And I mean, Eileen doesn't necessarily have any model of, she doesn't have any kind of model of lesbian love, right? Or any kind of clear way to, any structure to put that into, but there are a lot of things that make that, I think, much more evident. And I'd had a conversation with somebody ahead of seeing the movie where I said something to the effect of, like, I think the person I was talking to had compared it to the, based on the preview, had compared it to the movie Carol. And I said, well, no, like, Carol is about a lesbian attraction. And actually, like, even though they've kind of edited it in the preview to make it look as though this is, you know, a lesbian movie, like, it's actually not at all. Like, that element is completely not there. And then I watched the movie and looked pretty stupid because that element was there, right? But it's been added, and I think that the reason, the assumption that I had about why it was added to the movie was that it, you know, in a film you have to express things in a much more compressed way, and that if you can, the idea of saying, okay, well, this is a love affair, makes it easier and simpler, I think, to kind of express the idea of what the attraction actually means, or, you know, why Eileen is so drawn to this person. But of course, the film was written by Moshfegh, right? So part of me just thought, oh, did I miss something? Is there, like, a subtext in the book that I was completely blind to? And that was part of why I led off with that question, because watching the film and knowing they were, I mean, obviously, right, like, I don't think that changes to the film should be taken as, you know, any kind of commentary on the underlying meaning or intention of the book. But I was just wondering if there was something that I had missed because it's presented in that different way by the same person, if that makes sense.
I bet you some producer told her to play that up. I bet you $1 million.
I think that that's probably, you know, true. But also, I think that the... a lot of the book is very interior, like a lot. If I were to sort of like, cause I saw the trailer too, and I can, and it's kind of colors how I see the book actually, even though I haven't seen the movie, just how I picture different moments in my head. But if I were to read the book and then someone were to just tell me they were planning to make a movie, I would struggle to see, I would struggle to understand the you know, what the actual sort of narrative would be, that, you know, the things happening, you know, characters actually doing stuff that would actually comprise a whole movie. You know, it's not a lot actually happens in the book.
Right. Like the final like thriller part could be done in 30 minutes, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. And, but I do think that the two can sort of exist in harmony, because I think it's, you know, I don't know if I'm the only one who has had this experience, but when I was younger, I definitely wondered about myself. Like, I thought, like, do I have any, you know, homosexuality, any bisexuality in me? And I remember, you know, being around like an older boy once and like just sort of like thinking, wow, that guy's really handsome. And, you know, just asking those questions in my head and navigating that space. Turns out, pretty boring cisgender dude. That's me. But I definitely, I think, like, I think it's possible for a very unformed sexuality to kind of manifest, especially with really just terrible, again, like awful modeling around her for what healthy sexuality would be. Not that healthy sexuality is heterosexual, just any kind of norm that, you know, that would kind of inform her. I think it's possible for it to be sexual in a kind of naive sense, without being, you know, without her ever, and she talks, you know, from the perspective of the 70-plus-year-old Eileen, like, she talks about being with men from that point forward. She never mentions being with a woman again, I don't believe. But I think it's still possible for the two to kind of coexist, where she's not bisexual or lesbian, but because she has such unformed sexuality, she can be a kind of have sort of lesbian sexual interest in hypothesis, if that makes sense. And I can see that being easier to just sort of draw out in the movie and the author feeling comfortable with that.
Sure. Well, yeah. And I mean, I think in a movie like you complex feelings have to be simplified into things that can easily be conveyed through dialogue or action, right? I mean, I think for Eileen in the book, you know, Rebecca symbolizes sophistication and confidence and glamour and all these qualities that are totally alien to where she's grown up. And the attraction is probably much more so to the desire to be like that person, or, you know, in being accepted or liked by that person, to kind of become a bit more like that person. And I guess that's not totally impossible to represent on film, but and there's still obviously some component of all that in the film too. It's oversimplifying to say that that's not there, but Chris, this your comment about the action, that ties to another question that I had, which is, you know, this is, as you guys have noted, a very slow novel, right? In the sense that not really much happens until really like the last quarter, when you get into the thriller elements. But those don't come into play until after a great deal of scene setting. And Rebecca, I don't think that Rebecca really appears at all until about halfway through the novel.
Yeah, I thought that was the weird part. Like how she's supposed to be kind of like the inciting incident, and she doesn't show up till halfway through.
Well, I was going to ask, how did that pacing work for you guys? Did that seem strange or bothersome? Was that effective?
I would have preferred a faster paced novel, I think. A little less, you know, not that you'd want to miss out on a lot of that cool background, but we could get through it a little faster. That would have been my preference.
I'd be curious if you wanted to talk about it, if this is a characteristic of Mashvig, because My Year of Rest and Relaxation is literally about a woman hiding in her apartment from the world, and there is an element of slowness to that that is completely beautiful and powerful.
Yeah, but that's offset by all the prurience.
yeah, it's that book is much funnier. I think that helps. But I did not mind it in Eileen. I did think, it's just particularly impressive that the author could do this and it works. I don't think it works as well as that slow, that kind of like really the plotlessness of My Year of Rest and Relaxation. I think that the lack of a plot for most of this novel does not carry quite as strongly, but I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the experience of reading it, and I was really like compelled, I think, by the tension between the narrator and her younger self, and the two kind of the naive perspective of the younger self and the very like strong, opinionated, intelligent perspective of the older self. And I really enjoyed that, and I enjoyed the strangeness of the father and her relationship to the father, and I loved a lot about it. I do think I agree with Patrick in the end, though. It didn't quite need to be so belabored.
And I don't know. I mean, I suppose kind of like the period setting, right? Like it really, I don't have a great logical rebuttal against that other than to kind of shrug and say that I didn't mind it, you know? Like, I liked the texture of the voice and the narration enough that I wasn't particularly put off by the length of time that it took for something to happen. But, I mean, it seems totally reasonable to me for somebody to be bothered by that, right? And I don't think that it's, I mean, your description of it, I think, is accurate, right? Like, I can't argue about the accuracy of how you're naming it. It just didn't happen to be something that seemed problematic to me.
Is this a, because you've read her other, what is it, Paloma and...
Latvona,
not
and
Paloma.
Death in Her Hands.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've read everything of hers. Is the slowness characteristic of her? No, not necessarily. No.
Fascinating. I really want to read. I really don't want it to come across like I would recommend Eileen to just about anybody. I really liked it. It's just that I think her obvious like incredible skill sets a bar. For everything she writes. I mean, I mean, like, it's like the difference between, I don't know. I don't know how to put it. It feels like, she could get away with basically writing, anything and I would read it.
Well, and again, I mean, I do think that like the slowness is definitely there, right? And it's more a question of whether you're bothered by it or not, ultimately. And I don't have a great theory for why I wasn't bothered by it. It just wasn't something that really occurred to me to question or I don't even know that I thought of it consciously as being a slow novel until I was done with it, right? Until I kind of was sitting down to kind of go over what it was that had happened, and I really kind of realized, like, oh shit, like nothing happens until halfway through. And that slowness is not at all characteristic of everything that she's done. Her books are very, very different from each other, and the two after this, Death in Her Hands, in some sense, is very, very fast-paced, except, I suppose... Well, it's very fast-paced, but then in some sense, I suppose nothing happens at all ever in that one, actually, which I don't know how to talk about it much more without it being a spoiler. But Latvona, her most recent novel, that is very, very eventful in a completely opposite way. So, and that's a very different novel from the first three. So, you know, the slowness, I think that one thing that does allow us to do is really kind of linger in the details of Eileen's life. And there's a kind of a strong scatological element at the beginning and ending, right? One scene that happens very early on, I think one of the first things that happens, if I remember right, is Eileen purging with laxatives, right? She has this way of... this recurring habit of just, you know, taking a huge number of laxatives and shitting her guts out as this kind of purgative ritual, and something that she's very satisfied by. And that dovetails in an interesting way with the confession of Mrs. Polk at the end, where Mrs. Polk talks about giving her son enemas as part of kind of a ritual of sexual molestation. So what effect does that thread have, I guess? That how important is that, and what does it do?
I think it just reinforces in a very visual and experiential sense how just fucking toxic this environment is, you know, for Eileen, but... you know, and I don't know that this is like a town that is like all, you know, full up of sexual deviants and abusers and but it feels like the police force, her father, the Polks, the warden, it feels like the infrastructure of this place is really like designed to be sort of blind to all of this really gross, unhealthy behavior, all these pathologies. And I think that the purging scene at the beginning is, I don't want to, I think that threatens to make it too symbolic, but I don't think it's that, but I think it is very, it's a very visceral encapsulation of a pretty sick place, at least as the older Eileen, I think, remembers it.
I took it, I was kind of interested in the first scatological scene, kind of in a different trajectory, though, because purging is a behavior associated with eating disorders, right? And like purging with laxatives is definitely something that not just like throwing up, restricting, but also purging with laxatives is something that people with eating disorders if that works right here. So I was kind of interested in that aspect. Though I do like that metaphor, Chris. I think that that's interesting. Like, both of the scatological scenes are representative of the toxic reality of the setting we live in, and that's also a more generous, like, it's a more generous interpretation, because like if we look at it like the eating disorder trajectory, that was like a source of disappointment for me, because I wanted more of that. Like, I wanted, like, obviously in the 60s, eating disorders were understood much, much differently. Like, I don't even know if the term eating disorder had been coined yet. So that was, for me, that was an area where the setting failed. Like, I wanted, like, how would someone in the 60s understand an eating disorder? How would it, you know, like if it's happening in the 60s, like, what can we take away from like the experience of an eating disorder in the 60s, as opposed to now when it's understood in a little bit more detail? So that, like, as I said, that was probably another source of dissatisfaction for me, unfortunately. But I do like hearing the way you've put it, Chris. I like that metaphor, that like makes it a little more engaging for me.
You know, I'm thinking more and more about the voice of the older Eileen, and it seems like, I think it's very, at least I got the impression that the older Eileen is very, very invested in speaking accurately about this time. Like, I don't see any like angle of unreliability or anything like that, other than like her copping to the fact that she, you know, can't quite remember everything perfectly well, and she might have invented elements in the time.
Oh yeah, perfectly reliable, man.
But very, very reliable. Like, trying really, really hard.
Right.
Or no, trying really hard to be reliable, and that coupled with her intelligence, like, she's obviously very intelligent. Like, she's like a very, compared to, and I think young Eileen is clever, but very stunted intellectually, very frustrated intellectually, whereas the older Eileen is self-assured intellectually and emotionally, and very clear and transparent about like pretty awful things. And it feels like, if it feels like there's a kind of a line that Mashfig has to walk there, where like she has to kind of like explicitly say certain things, or just sort of like describe the elements of an eating disorder without, you know, explicitly like naming it. Because I think it's pretty clear that young Eileen at least has an eating disorder. And I think it seems clear that older Eileen is past that, but and I don't know if I totally agree with where you're coming from, but I think that if I were to sort of pull the threads of it, I think some of the threads lead to that the kind of comfortable, transparent, intelligent authority of the narrator who's telling us this story, and like, and maybe there's like another place that this novel could have gone if the narrator, announced certain things out loud, like the eating disorder. You know, we didn't know what that was at the time, but that's what it was. And I'm not there anymore.
I think I would have liked some more essayistic digressions from the older Eileen. Obviously, that's just my preference for like idea-based fiction, but
Well, and I think too, the image of the kind of purging with laxatives, like that's also an image of control, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like so much of the novel is full of these images of control and authority. The boys' prison, right? Like the whole point of the boys' prison is control and kind of the restriction of the lives of these boys. And so many of the key characters are police, right? Like Eileen's father is a policeman. If I remember right, I think Mr. Polk was a policeman before
yes.
his son murdered right. him. So that's relevant too, right? Like these images of control and authority, and a lot of what Eileen does with herself day to day seems like these kinds of really weird, toxic ways of striving for self-control or self-determination, right? Not just the purging, but like, you know, she has this habit of like not showering or bathing for days and kind of getting as gross as possible. And so I think everything that you guys have said is all very correct. And I think also the way that it functions as kind of a lever for some weird version of self-determination in this environment where there's so much authority, so much control, and so much of it is kind of arbitrary and sick and unjust or poorly functioning, right? Like it seems like a lot of what she's trying to do is kind of these small personal rebellious ways of trying to exert control. And the initial kind of purging scene, I think, is also notable as part of that. So the other thing that I was thinking about here was the kind of the doubling between Eileen's family and the Polk families, right? The ways in which those are not really even mirrors of each other, but just almost copies of each other in a way, right? The both fathers being policemen, the brief suggestion that Eileen's father has molested Joni, right? Which, you know, even in the narration, the older Eileen gives us enough clues in description to piece that together, but doesn't linger on that or discuss that or talk about that, which is somewhat out of character for her to not acknowledge. It seems like something that even as an older self, she's not quite able to explicitly say. So, and maybe there's not really too much left to be brought out here around this, but I was just really struck by the ways in which those two, the Polk family and Eileen's family, the ways in which those two kind of double and mirror each other and really how alike they are. And so, yeah, I just was wondering if you guys had any other thoughts about that, what that means or what that does.
I think it just works. I think it's just one of those things that like, I think it's one of those. So it just externalizes a lot of stuff for Eileen that is in her head, and it kind of takes the stakes out of her head and puts it into the plot of the novel. You know, she's thinking about murdering her father, but she's never actually going to murder her father. She hates him for a lot of reasons, some of which, like you said, might not be explicitly like spoken aloud or described by the narrator. And Rebecca, who we haven't really talked about, does some psychoanalyzing of the Polk family, that I guess could be read as sort of like reflective in a way of psychoanalyzing of Eileen's family, and you know, and of Eileen. You know, she talks about like everyone thinks it's, you know, Oedipal, and have you ever thought about, you know, murdering your father? And Eileen says no, but of course she's thought about it like for years. And so I think it just, I don't know. I feel like it would be, it would diminish the novel, for me to sort of like come with a thematic reason for it. It feels like just a really clever, good storytelling choice to kind of like make this other just completely like destroyed family resonant with her family. And there's one line that stuck out to me, because after she learns this the truth about the Polks, after she tells about learning about the truth about the Polks and what the father was doing to the son and what the mother was doing, she has this one offhand line that she says, like, you know, I guess it wasn't so bad for me, but then later I really did wonder who had it worse, which is a very interesting, like, it just sort of gestures at the depth of her suffering and some of the things that she was going through or had gone through, you know, that, you know, maybe she didn't get to, maybe she didn't describe, or maybe, you know, like the actual sort of description of what she was going through didn't quite get at the depths of her own suffering. But for her to kind of say that, you know, that her experience might have actually been worse than this completely fucking awful thing that happened to the Polks and to the Polk boy is pretty remarkable. It just sort of stuck out to me as a line. But going back to your question, I think it just is just one of those things that works for stories to have that kind of doubling, unless it doesn't work. But in this case, it does.
It definitely reinforces the like dark underbelly type thing, that, you know, like not only the scatological element that you mentioned earlier, Chris, is representative of the toxic environment, and the doubling. Like, we see Eileen's experience and with her father and how shitty her father is, and we've got this hint that her father has molested her sister. So we've got this, you know, some really disgusting shit going on. And then we see it happen again with the Polks. So that doubling does, you know, point out more, like, with both in tandem, points to like the toxic environment again, the dark underbelly again. So that's one way that the doubling thing, that's one reason why, Chris, you say it works, because it I mean, it does. It is working. I was wondering, does the doubling, like, is there more to this? Like, whenever someone mentions Freud, it's heavy, right? Like, with the Oedipal myth and all that. And I'm wondering, like, is that, like, so, you know, there's a joke, like, you know, I'm not suffering the Oedipal complex because I don't want to kill my father. It would really be the Clytemnestra complex or whatever, since we're talking about women. There's the joke there, like, I don't want to kill my father, even though, you know, Eileen has been thinking about it for years and years and years. And I'm wondering, is there something more to that? Does the doubling point us in a direction of, like, is the novel's clearly playing around with the Oedipal myth, but does the novel think the Oedipal myth is important and worth continuing on the discussion of the Oedipal myth, like as a method of describing human behaviors and desires, or is it just a joke?
Well, so what you said made me think, like, she has a plan laid out for basically destroying her father.
Right.
And she doesn't do it. You know, so, like, that would be at least a part of, that would be like a realization of the, of, you know, she could frame her father. And I think actually, given like how fucking crazy he is, like, I think, you know, I don't know if she'd get away with it, but certainly in her mind, it would work. So she doesn't do that. But she does choose to murder.
Well, it's like an accidental murder, right?
It's not an accidental murder. She's leaving the car, she's leaving the car running.
She's accidentally shot, but then she is purposely left to die.
Yeah, she's leaving, what's the last name again?
Polk. The Polk mom.
The Polk mom. To die, and I certainly am not weeping for the Polk mom, but she is killing,
sure,
and choosing to kind of spare her father. So I don't know how that factors.
Yeah, I don't either. It's interesting to think about, though.
Yeah, I think, you know, she's carving her way out. You know, I don't.
1 pound of flesh at a time.
Well, it sounds like Mrs. Polk had quite a bit. Definitely,
oh, yeah.
But, yeah. I don't know what that does to the Oedipal thing. It just seems interesting, like an interesting choice, and maybe just a flourish at the end, that she spares her father, you know, framing him.
All right. Well, since we're talking about the end of the novel there, seems like as good a time as any to end the podcast as well. So this has been our discussion of Eileen by Otessa Moshfegh, who I will, when I edit this, I'll probably go look up the precise way to pronounce her name and feel somewhat embarrassed for all three of us. Patrick, what are we doing next episode?
Let's read Julia by Sandra Newman. Which is a retelling from the main female character's perspective of George Orwell's 1984. I apologize in advance if this novel's not good. I've never read it. I just had heard of it like a couple months ago, and I was like, I would like to read that. I'm actually pretty skeptical. Like, I don't, you know, like, from what I read about it, it's a feminist, like, it's, the point is to, like, do a feminist version of 1984, which is fine, but I definitely, you know, I'm obviously I'm going to be skeptical because, like, 1984 is a novel by my favorite author, and I think it's great. I think it's wonderful. Like, what could you do by retelling it? But, like, I also want to challenge myself and see whether I think it's good. So the plan would be to read Julia, and then, like, I do want to compare it to 1984, so, like, some knowledge of 1984 will probably be beneficial. But, yeah.
All right. Well, that sounds... I have to admit, Patrick, when you and I had talked before and you'd indicated this would be your choice for next week, and I thought that sounds really depressing and unpleasant, and I wish she had not done that, but you have, so we're going to do it.
Yeah. It. You know, 1984, well, you know.
1984 is fantastically
good. You are
good.
Right.
I mean, it's a brilliant achievement.
But it is
I
depressing.
Fucking hate
but it is
it.
Depressing. And the little coda that Orwell added to make it less depressing somehow doesn't work that well. Like, I think the coda is fine. Like, I don't think it's a flaw, but it certainly doesn't make you feel too much better, you know. Anyway.
All right. Well, this has been the Book Spider Podcast, and we'll see you all in a couple weeks for the thing Patrick picked that I've already forgotten.
Julia
by...
Sandra Newman.
Julia by Sandra Newman. All right. Thank you much.
All right, peace out,
guys.
Dudes.
Later. Yeah, it was a pleasure.
As always.